Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Zingari. It's opera first this morning. Then we'll learn about plans for a recreation hub in the Mad River Valley and how you can share your thoughts about it. At 10, we're going to hear why some Vermonters want us all to pay more attention to the wakes we make in our lakes. And we'll finish the morning by meeting members of the Poetry Society of Vermont. But let's begin the morning by warming up the vocal cords and singing an aria or two, or at least learn how young people in Vermont who are interested in opera get their start. Joining me now is Sarah Cullins, the founder and executive director of the Youth Opera Company of Vermont. Sarah, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning.
Good morning. Great to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Sarah about the Opera Company, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Sarah, when did your love affair with opera begin?
Well, that's a long question. I was incredibly privileged to have family who lived in New York City and who were classical music fans and operaphiles. So I had a grandmother and a great aunt who took me to the opera for the first time when I was 13. And I returned many times on family vacations. And actually also at that time at the Flynn here in Burlington, the New York City Opera Traveling Company often came by. And so I also saw Barbara of Seville right here in Burlington, which unfortunately doesn't happen anymore. And as a kid growing up here in Burlington, like most of my students, I did a lot of choral singing. I did a lot of musical theater. I took voice lessons starting in my freshman year at Burlington High School. And there was always this, you know, decision, was I going to try to pursue musical theater or opera? And ultimately, the additional challenges of opera, such as learning lots of different foreign languages, and the technical challenges and the high notes and and the historical piece, the literature piece, all of those things were what drew me towards opera.
Ah, interesting. Because, yeah, that is definitely difficult. Do you remember the first time that you performed opera in public?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I sort of had an introduction when I was still here in Vermont in high school, because I sang with the Vermont Mozart Festival and Aurora Singers, which was then Oriana Singers. And so they put on productions of Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, and I was in the chorus. So that was my first little segue into the medium. But my first operatic role was actually in Boston at Tufts University, and I was a freshman, and we did a production of Dido and Aeneas by Purcell, and I was Belinda.
Ah, nice.
So that was my first official role.
Well, your road to opera is very interesting, and I promise we will talk more about the Youth Opera Company of Vermont, but you wound up going to Columbia. So tell us a little bit about your career in South America.
Actually, the interesting thing was I was sort of on a singing hiatus when I arrived in Columbia for a lot of different personal reasons. After being there for a few years, I heard about their national voice competition. And my boyfriend at the time said, "Hey, this is the perfect way to get you back into singing, you know, to motivate you." And I said, "Okay, here we go." And I prepared for the audition and I ended up winning that competition. And that, you know, was a very nationally, followed competition, and ended up landing me with lots of performing opportunities with the Bogota Philharmonic and the National Symphony. And then things just sort of spiraled from there. And I did a lot of opera, but a lot of symphonic and oratorio work in Colombia for 10 years.
Oh, how exciting. You never know what door is going to open for you, especially when you avail yourself to an opportunity. So well done.
Absolutely.
Sarah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sarah, what is the Youth Opera Company of Vermont?
So I kind of liken us to sort of an interscholastic varsity singing team. These are, these are kids who really love classical singing. They are taking voice lessons, and there aren't a lot of after-school singing, high-level singing opportunities for singers in Vermont. I should actually revise that statement. There aren't any after-school, other than what's offered by the schools themselves, which are generally another choral experience, which is absolutely wonderful for ear training, for the musical aspect. Obviously, our choir directors here in Vermont are incredibly skilled and knowledgeable, and students learn a lot about their voice in those situations, but it's not the same as individual training. And so in the Youth Opera Company, we put on small productions, sometimes opera scenes, sometimes, what we just recently did was we took the second act of Strauss's opera, Die Fledermaus, and we made it sort of its own opera, and we called it Orlovsky's Ball. And so I made sure that every single singer who was there had their own solo. So sometimes that meant borrowing arias from other operas and working it into the storyline. And we created our own production. So everyone really is treated as a soloist, and their individual process is really important to us. I'm always in contact with the teachers, the voice teachers of all of the students, many of whom are mine, but many of whom are not. So that, we're really making sure each student is kind of following their own vocal and artistic path. But we also offer workshops. So in the fall, we tend to do audition workshops because a lot of students are applying for festivals such as New England and All-State Music Festivals, or they're about to apply to colleges. And auditioning is a terrifying thing that requires lots of practice and a totally different skill set. And hopefully this fall we'll also start a artist in residency program. I'm hoping to be at Burlington High School, going in once a week and helping them prepare a production of Dido and Aeneas within their own chorus class.
Ah, fantastic.
With the idea of just trying to explain that, opera is really just storytelling, just like all the other forms of storytelling we know, and is not so inaccessible or strange or unrelatable.
When did you start the opera company, and what did it take to get it going? As you said, there weren't any opportunities for these young people who are interested in opera at the time.
Yeah, so in 2019, we began as a satellite program of the Middlebury Community Music Center, which is a fabulous organization down in Middlebury. I just really enjoyed meeting Sadie Brightman, who's the executive director of that of this community center in Middlebury. And we had a lot in common, and I was explaining what I was hoping to be able to do for these really talented young singers here in Vermont. And so she suggested that it could be a satellite program using the Middlebury Community Music Center as a base. And so that's how I ran it for our first year and a half before COVID shut things down. And then recently it just became clear that, I needed to have my own board for fundraising purposes. And because I'm based in Burlington, it really made sense to be a little bit more local and to finally establish ourselves as a nonprofit.
Now, you've been a performer. You're working with these young people. What does it take to perform opera? nice reaction.
It's funny because I think for a lot of these kids, certainly none of them grew up thinking, I'd like to be an opera singer.
Right.
When you grow up in Vermont, it's definitely something that someone has to tell you might be suited for and that you might enjoy. We are not trying to train a whole new generation of professionals or pre-professionals. Of course, some of the students who come into the program do end up majoring in music and in vocal performance when they go to college or conservatory, but that's not the main goal. The main goal is really to explore all these multidisciplinary aspects of operatic training, which obviously include the vocal piece, but also include the language piece. So generally, we try to pick an opera that we will sing either in the original language or a combination of English and the original language, like what we just did with Die Fledermaus. And so I also teach them diction in that language. So we learn the symbols for the international phonetic alphabet and how to transcribe the language of the opera into that international phonetic language so that we can read it correctly and pronounce the words correctly. And we talk about style, we talk about character, we talk about historical context of the opera that we're singing. So, you know, there are clearly things that in different time periods were very different. And so we talk about what that context is and what that would mean today for these characters and, you know, why that's important or how is it relevant or not to today. So there's definitely a historical, musical, stylistic, linguistic, vocal and then physical training as well in terms of just being able to sustain that kind of singing for, you know, our productions tend to be less than an hour, but obviously once you're on a professional stage, it might be 2 or 3 hours that you're singing in this very sort of extreme way.
Wow. Sarah, opera is not something that most kids are walking around singing or many that I know. So how do you find those with an interest and a talent who, you know, opera is well suited for?
I really heavily rely on my colleagues in public schools and private schools, my choral conducting colleagues. So, you know, obviously I send out flyers and things sort of to general places and, you know, within schools, but I know that that's not really where I'm going to find those students. So I reach out to my colleagues who are voice teachers, my colleagues who are choir teachers, and, you know, really just ask them, do you have anyone who you think would be interested and who is currently taking voice lessons or might be interested in taking voice lessons? Because obviously it's really important to make sure that students are singing properly and carefully as they are singing this repertoire. And there are a couple other organizations that are trying to give younger students some more singing opportunities, like the Greater Burlington Children's Chorus, which is, you know, geared towards slightly younger kids, but hopefully that will be a little bit more of a feeder in the future for teens who might be interested. But you'd also be surprised, you know, opera is in a lot of pop culture without us even noticing it. So once these kids start singing it, they start realizing that it's kind of already been around them from the Looney Tunes cartoons that, okay, maybe teenagers these days aren't watching, but we certainly did growing up.
We did.
Things like, for example, I was just watching the new season of Bridgerton, and there was this scene that's happening, and all of a sudden Adele's waltz from Die Fledermaus came on, and I quickly called my student who was singing that aria in the opera we were presenting, and I said, oh my gosh, have you seen the new season of Bridgerton season, you know, episode 5, there's your aria. She said, I know, I just saw it too. And then yesterday I was watching actually the first Downton Abbey movie, because I heard the second one was coming out. I'd never seen the first one. And again, in a scene, there was an orchestral version of an aria that another one of my singers had just sung from a very obscure opera, so I had to call them and say, hey, nice. Have you seen this movie? Did you notice that your aria was in the middle? So, you know, it is all around us. It's just that we don't perhaps recognize it, or, you know, until you've done it, you don't realize that it's not this, right, that it is relatable. It is just telling stories, and it's beautiful music, yeah. And it is in our ear, even though we don't recognize it at first, perhaps.
You mentioned, you used the words properly and carefully about how they sing. I would imagine there's certain ways you have to approach opera so as to not to hurt your voice or strain your voice. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, although I would argue that in order to sing any genre without you know, hurting your voice, you need to learn the proper technique. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether you're singing pop or musical theater or opera, training is key. And, you know, it's one of those things, because we all have a voice inside our bodies, we all have this instrument, it's easy to feel like, oh, I can sing, I can just, you know, use my voice. I use it all day, every day. I sing along with the radio. But, you know, we would never be quite so cavalier about the piano or the violin. You know, you would take sure. lessons to learn how to play those instruments carefully, to not get injuries like tendonitis, right? Or also, obviously, to reach a higher level. And in singing, it's very similar. Singing is a full body experience, much more so than any other instrument, because it literally is in your body. And, you know, we all have habits that kind of creep in from the way we speak, from the way we stand. There might be tensions that we use, or, you know, bad habits that we've kind of gotten into that would really affect any genre that we sing. But of course, because when you're singing opera, you're tending to sing, you know, high notes, more sustained notes. It's more of a, the physical aspect is a little bit more elevated. So, you know, just like, you know, this is where I go back to the sports analogy, just like someone who's doing varsity sports, yep. you really need to make sure that you're not injuring yourself and that you can sustain that endurance that's required.
How many members do you currently have in the company, and where do they come from?
Well, for our last production of Orlovsky's Ball, we had 9 singers, and they came from U32, Harwood Union High School, Rice Memorial High School, a recent grad from Essex High School, Burlington High School. Let me think. Am I missing anybody? We've had members in the past from, as well, from South Burlington, from CVU. This time we also had a student join us from UVM. So really, nice. From all over.
Like it.
Well, all over Chittenden and Washington counties, and occasionally from Madison County as well.
Gotcha. And next up, you'll be performing at the Isham Family Farm in Williston. Tell us about that.
Great. Yeah. So on June 13th, 4 of our graduating seniors will be offering a recital of opera and art song. So art song meaning those classical songs in Italian, French, German, a leader and chanson, those kind of things. And this is a recital for them to sort of mark the passage of their graduation and the end of this high school process, but also to raise money for our scholarship fund. You know, studying individual weekly voice lessons is obviously a big expense for a lot of families, as well as joining one of our programs. And we really want to make sure that our programs are accessible to every Vermonter who's interested. So we're really excited to be raising some money and celebrating these 4 seniors who've done such an amazing job. So they'll be singing arias and duets from The Marriage of Figaro, from Die Fledermaus, from our recent production, and as well as some songs from Schubert, by Schubert, Fauré, John Duke, and Amy Beach.
And what do you hope these students will do with what they're learning from you?
Well, clearly some of them will, you know, will try to pursue a professional career. But, you know, as I tell all of them, classical music and the arts and opera doesn't only need professional artists and participants, but there's so many ways to participate in the arts, whether it's, you know, as an administrator, as a donor, as a ticket buyer, as a promoter. You know, we all just passed through a pandemic listening to music, you know, really using the arts to survive these past 2 years. But unfortunately, the arts are so underfunded and undersupported in this country that it's really up to lovers of the arts to make it possible. And so whether they are in the audience or behind the scenes writing the grants or on stage, I hope this experience just leads to a lifetime of participation in the arts.
Sarah, you're still performing. Tell us about your upcoming shows with Bella Voce.
Yeah, this weekend, my husband and I, as part of our duet, which is called Ocho Cuerdas, 8 Strings, will be performing with the Bella Voce Women's Choir. And their program has some sort of classical and opera in the beginning. And then the second half of the program is dedicated to more Spanish music or Spanish-inspired music. So we'll be performing with them I'll be soloing with them, and then my husband Danielle and I will be also doing a couple of our own pieces, which will be lots of fun, very spirited pieces. Some things I think audience will definitely recognize, and everyone's just having a lot of fun preparing.
And how can people support the Youth Opera Company?
We are currently working on our website, but anyone can certainly reach me on the Youth Opera email, which is youthoperavt@yahoo.com. And we do have a Facebook page, the Youth Opera Company of Vermont. And we always accept donations and phone calls of support and emails of support. But really by coming to some of our performances and just really supporting the talent and hard work of these young Vermont teens.
Sarah Collins is the founder and the executive director of the Youth Opera Company of Vermont. And you can learn more by visiting the Facebook page. Sarah, I want to thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News Update and then come back to hear how a $400,000 grant is going to create a recreation opportunity in the Mad River Valley. And coming up today at 1, we've got the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. That's followed by 2 hours of The Getaway, hosted by the Grizzly, Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. The pandemic did a lot of things that we'll look back on and gnash our teeth about, but it also got us outside, taking advantage of recreational opportunities, something we were already big fans of here in Vermont. Well, a recent $400,000 grant will mean a new recreation hub in the Mad River Valley. We're going to learn about the grant, what the hub might include, and how you can provide input into what gets created. Joining me now to discuss it is Ross Saxton, Executive Director of the Mad River Path. Ross, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me on this beautiful Vermont morning.
It is beautiful. And we also have Mad River Valley Chamber of Commerce Executive Director Eric Friedman with us. Eric, thank you for being here as well.
Yeah, I appreciate the invite. Thanks so much.
Sure thing. Listeners, to ask our guests about the grant they've received or about plans for the recreation hub in the Valley, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Ross, tell us again what the Mad River Path is.
Sure, yeah. So we create and maintain a network of public pathways around the Mad River Valley. Our long-term mission here is to connect the four towns, including Moortown, Faiston, Waitsfield, and Warren, with one continuous pathway, which we're still working on and have made a lot of progress over the years and have some new sections coming again in the next year or two. So the idea is that they're very accessible to anyone who wants to go for a walk. You can bike some of these sections too. A lot of them are near the river, so you can have fishing access. It's great bird watching, nature relaxing. So it's just a real nice place or places where you can get outside in the nature and enjoy the outdoors.
If I walked every part of the path right now, Ross, how many miles would I go? How long might it take me?
Sure. So we have about 11 miles right now, and that's, like I said, growing every year a little bit. And the really cool thing about it, too, is we connect up with a lot of trails that our partners manage. For example, the Mad River Riders manage about 60 or more trails, some of which you can get to directly from the path. So we have a lot of really cool partners to keep expanding this network in a environmentally responsible way that we're working on improving every year.
Eric, what do you think the Mad River Path adds to the quality of life in the valley?
It's enormous. I mean, I think that not only for visitors, but also for our residents, is that people come here for outdoor recreation, and it's really, really important that we provide good experiences for, like I said, for both the residents as well as visitors. And These trails are just huge, and these access points are our ways to get out into nature and out into the woods and out to the river and all of that. So it's hugely important.
And how does this benefit businesses, you know, in attracting tourists, also in attracting people to work at the valley businesses?
Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought up about the workers. You know, everyone here, or not everyone, but the vast majority of the people that are in this community are here because of outdoor recreation. So by enhancing and improving and taking care of all of these recreational assets, it's really vital that we do that, because the businesses that are here are all interrelated with it and are dependent upon it, and not necessarily directly. I mean, obviously, the inns and lodges and restaurants, you know, there's a direct correlation between, you know, the outdoor recreation and business. But for the other, you know, not necessarily direct connections, you know, whether they be, you know, lawyers or, you know, or accountants, or, I mean, almost anything else is why people live here.
Yeah.
So, it's really, really important, and not necessarily directly, but tangentially as well.
Ross, what are VOREC grants?
Yeah, it's a program from the state. It's VOREC stands for Vermont Outdoor Recreation Economic Collaborative. I believe I got that correct. The whole idea is that the state provides these competitive grants to a variety of organizations and municipalities to create these recreation opportunities that simultaneously enhance the economy of local areas. So we were fortunate to receive one of those. We got together through our pre-existing Mad River Valley Trails Collaborative, which is a really diverse kind of group of us. So we have our trail nonprofits, we have the chamber, who's a big leader in this, our recreation district, our planning district, Friends of the Mad River is another partner. So a lot of us, some folks who you might not think is directly related with recreation, but they really are. So we got together and said, hey, there's this really cool project that we think would enhance downtown Waitsfield. And within Waitsfield, folks might know that Irisville is a village. It's kind of where all the businesses are here, right along Route 100, kind of in what we call the heart of the valley. We have a whole trail, it's called the Heart of the Valley, that comes down through the middle of the village here. So working with our partners, the Mad River Riders, which is the local Vermont Mountain Biking Association chapter here, they're really active with a lot of members from all over the place. They had this really cool idea that they've been wanting to do as a way to connect up to about 40-plus miles of trails. That's not accessible from downtown right now, but we're saying, well, how cool would it be if we could access everything from downtown? So we all got talking, and Eric here has a vision of a recreation hub with a new visitor center that's really kind of right when you drive by town, you see it. You're like, oh, I can just swing by here year round and get info on what to do outside. And then, there could be some enhanced parking here, so folks have a place they can just park and then get on the trails and get the info and visit a restaurant. And then the other part of this that we were thinking was, well, wouldn't it be cool if we could create a new path so people can walk or bike right into downtown without ever having to travel on the road, you know, maybe just cross the road at a crosswalk or something. Mm-hmm. So Eric, it all kind of came together.
Yeah.
And we applied and we got, yeah, the largest grant of this round to do this big project.
Mm. Eric, how much were you awarded, and are there specific guidelines that you need to meet to use this?
Oh, sure. Yeah, the full grant was $408,000. And what was really remarkable about it was when we applied for it, we didn't expect to get the full grant. Because it was so competitive, and there were so many other grant requests out there. So we, as we were going through the planning of all this and getting the grant, we were kind of wondering, like, oh, you know, what if we get X amount? What if we get Y amount? And, we ended up getting exactly what we asked for, which was really remarkable. And as Ross mentioned, it was the largest of the VORAC grants that were given out this year. So we're really proud of that. And I think it's a real testament to the fact that we were all working together so closely. And there were five pillars of the VORAC grant. And I think that we really hit the nail on the head and checked every box, as they say, with that. And Ross, I'm going to have to help you get what those five pillars are. But it was, it was economic. It was educational. Help me out with this, Ross. What were the five pillars again?
Oh, geez, I'm scrambling on Google here to look them up.
We got two of the five. You hit them all. But go ahead, Ross. Hit us.
Yeah, grow outdoor recreation-related business. Mm-hmm. Increase participation in outdoor recreation activities in a diverse way among all the demographics. Strengthen the quality and extent of outdoor recreation resources. Increase stewardship of outdoor recreation resources and environmental quality. And the last one is promote and enjoy the health and wellness benefits of outdoor recreation.
They're all important, but they don't just roll off the tongue. So I understand why you had to look them up. Ross, what is the timeline for the project?
Yeah, so we're currently working with the community. And as you mentioned before, there's a public participation opportunity later tonight, which we can give you some details on. We've already had some public forums in the past, and we've had a lot of conversations with individuals and groups over the last several months. But we'll continue to keep that participation process open and transparent as much as we possibly can going forward. So with that said, we're working closely with the town and VTrans on finalizing the permits for the whole project. There's some surveying that needs to get complete a little bit. So it depends a little bit on how all that goes and how long it takes. But it's possible that we'll have all that done this year, and we'll break ground on the bridge across the Mill Brook that will access the big part of this project that the riders are working on, and that will access all the trails up on that state land Howe block and some private land as well. All in all, we should be done with everything by next year,
wow,
at the latest, 2023.
Eric, tell us about the visitor center that the chamber will create as part of this hub.
Yeah, that's, I think, for us is the most exciting part of this whole project is that we're going to have a place right on the corner of Route 100 and Route 17 where so much traffic goes by to give people a place where they can go to get information and kind of create a sense of place where the information all year round. And I think that's one of the things that's most important, whether it be for you for backcountry skiing in the winter, or for riding or for walking or hiking, and just have a really visible place where people can come and we can tell the whole Mad River Glen, the whole Mad River Valley story, and about outdoor recreation, and also give a home to all of our partner organizations like the Mad River Path and the Mad River Riders and the Mad River Backcountry Coalition and all of the various groups so that people can get information about that. And we have a great cadre of volunteers that will help that we already have in our current visitor center, but we'll be able to expand that participation out a lot more and just really provide great information in a really cool setting. And we have a big relief map of the whole area so people can get the lay of the land of it and find out where they can go eat and where they can stay and camp and all sorts of things.
Ross, how has the Mad River Path grown over the past few years, and how will this grant foster continued growth?
Yeah, so we've been around for few decades, so at a certain point things become a little bit more opportunistic with where we expand to, but also we have opportunities that like this grant can give us where we can be really proactive and intentional. Of over the last, I'd say, 5+ years, we've really been working on those downtown connections. Our mission, as I was kind of saying before, is all about connecting people to the special places of the Mad River Valley. And our businesses are some of the most special places, I think. We have a lot of really unique businesses that people come from all over the place to come to. There's been this gap that we've identified downtown, which is the southern route. So this grant is really allowing us to propose to the community that we make that connection on the southern part of town. And it continues the path in a place where a lot of people, I think, are going to find a lot of value and benefit. That intersection that Eric just mentioned between Route 100 and Route 17 is a little bit of a tricky one. We really don't want people on the road around that curve. It's a dangerous spot. So if we can create this path to let folks get around it, I know it's a huge value for pedestrians and bikers from a safety perspective and connectivity perspective as well.
Eric, I understand that on Thursday nights, group rides on the path are the place to be in the valley. Is my intel correct?
Yeah, it's the Med River Riders have a big group ride that goes out every week, and they meet. And I think what's kind of interesting about this is that where this trail, where the recreation hub is going to be, has organically become the center of mountain biking in our community. So we're kind of piggybacking on what's already happened organically, as I said, and absolutely, it's a place to go. And there's riders going. Like tons and tons of riders going out every Thursday night, and they break down into groups by ability, and it's a really a wonderful thing.
Now, Ross, there's a Zoom meeting tonight. You kind of alluded to that. So, first of all, how do people access it, and who's invited to attend?
Yeah, everybody's invited. We want to make sure that anyone who's interested or has an opinion or just curious can join us. One place I can point folks to check out a little article about it is in our local paper, the Valley Reporter, just valleyreporter.com. Right on the front homepage, you'll find a link to that, and you can find the Zoom link on there. And the presentation tonight starts at 5 p.m. It'll go until probably about 6:30 or so. We'll have a presentation there, of course, with an update on what's going on, but we really want to give people a lot of time to ask questions and have any discussions that folks want to have. So you won't just be listening to us talk the whole time. There'll be lots of chances to chime in and talk with folks. And there's one other component too to this project I wanted to describe real quick. And it really hits the pillar about environmental stewardship, and which, by the way, Eric here with the chamber has been doing an incredible job in general with really pushing the ecological stewardship side of things, but taking care of our recreation assets and our river and wildlife and that kind of thing. He started up with all our partners something called Steward MRV, which is a part of this for sure. But what we're doing with our partners is that the VORC grant is allowing us to do is take a really deep dive into how trails and our trail network are laid out across the landscape and how that might influence the ecology of the valley and how that might be affecting wildlife. You know, are there some places maybe where we shouldn't put trails down the road because it's really important, you know, bear habitat, or maybe there's some wild ginseng patch somewhere that we want to make sure that we don't impact, you know, or other endangered species. So that's really deep dive around how trails are affecting wildlife. It's kind of a statewide conversation right now that a lot of folks are looking at, and we're really fortunate that we're going to be able to zoom in here in the Mad River Valley and think about that as a collaboration. So it's a really, really neat part of this opportunity that we have too from the VORC grant.
Eric, the Mad River Path website called this grant and this project a game changer. So why is this such a big deal for the Valley and for your organization?
Well, I think for the Valley, you know, I think we're somewhat geographically challenged. When people come here, you know, we're a multi-town community. People don't necessarily differentiate between the towns. They don't necessarily understand the geography and what the valley really looks like. And I think that this will help give a central location to it. And I think, as you know, as Ross mentioned earlier, it really, the most important thing is how it connects our trail system to our downtown. And that is just something that we've not had before. And it's really, really important that we're able to do that. And our business community really appreciates it and understands it. And they see the value in it, which is, you know, another, you know, thing that makes it a game changer. And I think that the other really big part of it is the fact that, this whole effort, as you know, the word that keeps coming up is collaborative. And our, these groups that we've been working with and our partner organizations, including the towns and the conservation commissions, this is something that we've been working together for a number of years as part of the Trails Collaborative. And, you know, over time, we've gotten more comfortable with one another. We understand each other better. And we keep building on that foundation. And the how well we work together is really remarkable. And I think that that's one of the things that is a testament to what the Mad River Valley is all about and what differentiates us from a lot of other places. And I'm really proud to be working with these other partner organizations. You know, the chambers of commerce are typically not organizations that are putting you know, ecology and stewardship at the forefront of what they do. But for us, it's super important because we recognize why outdoor recreation is so important. And so I'm really proud that our business community gets that.
Absolutely.
And they understand that and really are encouraging of this collaboration. So
that's Eric Friedman, Executive Director of the Mad River Valley Chamber of Commerce. We've also been speaking with Ross Saxton, the Executive Director of the Mad River Path. Zoom meeting tonight at 5 o'clock. You can find the link at valleyreporter.com. Eric and Ross, thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you, Rick. Enjoy the week.
All right, you too. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, then return to talk about lake wakes. And coming up tonight at 6:20, we've got Red Sox in Atlanta. First pitch against the Braves is 7:20. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Sengary. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs, including Healthcare Today and The Brady Farkas Show, on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. If I was given a quiz last week to explain wakeboarding, wake surfing, or wake-enhanced sports in general, I probably would have failed miserably. Not that I'd pass with flying colors now. But I was contacted by a group that is concerned about these activities on our lakes and the need for all of us to share our waterways responsibly. You know, the Vermont way. Joining me now are two members of Responsible Wakes for Vermont Lakes. Mark Malazzo, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick, for having us.
You're welcome. And we have Jack Widnes. Jack, thank you for being here as well.
Rick, I'd like to extend my thanks to you for having us get the information out.
Absolutely. Listeners, to ask our guests about what their organization stands for, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Mark, what is Responsible Wakes for Vermont Lakes?
So, Rick, we're a grassroots organization. We've been together over a year now. I got involved, I think it was last March. We're, you know, our makeup is fishermen, skiers, boaters, canoers. We really run the range in terms of the people that are involved in this group, and we're all over the state of Vermont.
And, Jack, why did you form this organization?
Well, it grew organically, I would say. There was a group in northern Vermont that knew of my interest in wake boats and the effects that they can have on our lake, adverse. They contacted me, and we agreed that this was a potential problem and that there were feasible solutions if we worked together on it.
Mark, what are these wake boats and the wake sports that have the members of your groups concerned?
So the whole idea around the wake boat is, of course, is to create a large wake behind the boat. And those wakes can be anywhere from 2 to 5 feet. And, you know, where technology is going with wake boats, the wakes are getting higher and higher. But basically, a couple of things drive the design of a wake boat. One is the drive system in the motor. They push the motor all the way to the back of the boat. They turn it around so that the drive shaft comes out towards the front of the boat and then V's out towards the bottom of the to the bottom of the boat. They also use things like wedge plates, you know, on the back of the boats. Again, the whole idea is to get that boat plowing through the water. And then the other area is sealed ballast tanks. So basically, these boats can take on 1,000 to 3,000, in some cases, 5,000 pounds of water in a very, very short period of time. Again, think about a boat just as it starts to take off, plowing through the water. And that's what these folks are. Now, a number of companies manufacture these boats today, but you can modify an existing boat to become a wake boat like.
And the boats, the sports that, you know, these are used for, have they been going on for a while, or we have just seen a spike in them recently?
You know, I think they've been going on. It's a relatively new sport, mm-hmm. and that's why we're, you know, again, we're one of the reasons why we're looking to address it. I would say it's early stages in Vermont, but, you know, based on all the research and the discussions we've had around the country, it's very, very popular. Popular in the South, popular in the Midwest, and popular out West.
Now, Jack, Mark
so
mentioned.
Just to amplify that.
Yeah,
so
please.
The boats have been around for a while. In fact, they've been at least for 25 years. And one of the things that has happened over this 25-year period with these wake boats is their power and their weight, their dry weight, has doubled over that period of time. So they've been around, but as Mark said, they're new to Vermont.
And, Jack, Mark mentioned that, you know, their wake will be 2 to 5 feet. So that sounds a lot, but I don't know. How does that, you know, compare to what we would see from a typical ski boat?
Oh, it's much more, much, much more. I mean, that's what catches your eye about these boats, that they plow through the water. They're going much slower. They're going like 10 miles per hour, whereas a ski boat would go between 20 and 30. The ski boats are skimming along the water, and this plowing is what they generate these waves. And I mean, this is what caught my attention on my lake when I first saw the boats going around a couple of years ago. The waves come over my dock. They're really forceful. I live here year-round. I see all sorts of waves on the lake at all times of the year. These are way beyond what at least I see on my small lake. I'm on Lake Raponda here in southern Vermont. But they're much in excess of anything I've ever seen, at least with wind on my lake.
Now, Jack, when I lived in Florida, areas close to shore had no wake zones to protect certain aquatic life like manatees. And granted, we don't have sea cows in our lakes here. But, you know, are you looking to institute something similar, that there'd be no wake zones or that there'd be restrictions on the wake that these boats would be allowed to create?
Well, let me just say that in Vermont, there is a 200-foot shoreline safety zone, which is in effect right now. This is part of Vermont statute, and it's for all the reasons that you mentioned. But what we're asking for in this reconsideration of the changing of the Vermont public water rules is that this be extended out further into the lake. We're asking that instead of 200 feet for wake boats and wake boat only, that this be extended to 1,000 feet. So our objective is to get these boats out into an area where they're less likely to have much, much less adverse impacts into deeper waters far from shore. And this, as I say, only applies to the wake boats Mark described. This does not apply to ski boats, party boats, anything else. Now, it's not that other boats couldn't go in this area where the wake boats are, but wake boats doing their sports should only be 1,000 feet from shore for the reasons we put forth in our petition.
Let's go to the phones, take a call from Fred in Bristol. Hi, Fred. Go right ahead.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to comment. I think this is just one of those, the new type of recreation is coming out. It's kind of like water skiing when it first started off years and years ago.
I can't hear the question.
When they first started off. Years and years ago, Some lakes don't allow jet skis. Some have a speed limit. I don't know if the speakers talked yet, but the wakes, not only to damage the docks and the boats that are on the shore, but also the shoreline can get washed away, too, by the wakes that that aren't even natural. So there's got to be a place for these boats, but perhaps some lakes just aren't there. It's not there for some lakes.
Mm, gotcha, Fred. So, Mark, Fred's point is, we'll first talk about, ski boats and jet skis. When they first came on the scene, there was probably some angst, right, because of what they were creating as far as wake and noise and, so how did we work with those pieces and, to come to an agreement, probably what you're working on today, with wake boats?
Well, Rick, these boats are – I'm a lifelong boater. I water skied. My daughter water skied. I don't have a ski boat anymore, but I have a pontoon boat. So I'm familiar with boats and have been around them for a long time. These are a game changer, right? So not only are there huge waves being produced by these, which have an impact on shoreline, on people kayaking, paddling around the lake – but they also have, because they're plowing through the water, because of the way the drive shaft is set up, there's a prop wash that's going down. And it's one of the other things that we're asking for is a 20-foot limit. These boats can't be operated within a 20-foot limit. Because basically, that prop wash is scouring the bottom of the lake, right? So fish habitat, if you've got phosphorus in the pond, milfoil, you can move that around. So these are really a game changer. So I think from my vantage point, and what I was, going through the research, it's about finding balance on the water. I mean, we have to all enjoy this. Mm-hmm. And these boats, these are different. And when they're on a lake, they really monopolize the real estate on the lake.
Jack, the other point that our caller Fred made was about the impact on the shoreline. What do you know about how this increased wake does affect our shoreline environment?
Well, there are studies and reports of that, anecdotal. And if you have these large waves that I described just a minute ago, when they hit shore, they certainly cause erosion. They cause, to give you an example from the state of Oregon, they caused massive erosion along the Willamette River there. And, in fact, just in the last few months, they have some very sensitive areas that they've marked off, and there's been legislation which has recently passed to prohibit because of the erosion on the shoreline and other effects along the Willamette River to not allow this. This is the first time that this has happened. But that, just gives you an example of the areas that can be affected. I should say that this is the most sensitive areas in our areas in Vermont are the areas that are not towards the windward side, because the windward parts of lakes are often hardened shores. But we're worried about these, in particular, these areas that are not in the windward side that often have a habitat for wildlife, among them loon nesting and whatnot, and the effect that it can have on wildlife, as well as shore erosion itself.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Michelle in Plainfield. Hi, Michelle. Go right ahead.
Hi. I personally know nothing about boats or lakes, but mm-hmm. my husband grew up on Saranac Lake with a boat, and when we go out on his boat on Lake Champlain, he's always pointing out and complaining that people don't follow the rules. They don't slow down when you're supposed to, when you're passing another boat. They do various things that he knows about that I don't know about.
Sure.
So my question is, how do you enforce any of this?
Mm.
It's fine to make the rules, but yep. How do you enforce it? We never see, a boat going around and telling people what to do. And it also seems it also seems people don't know the rules, or they're just not obeying them. Okay,
all right.
And I'll take the answer off the phone.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle. Mark, excellent questions there. Let's start with, first of all, enforcement. You know, all the rules in the world are great, but who is actually enforcing the rules on these waterways?
So there's several groups that I'm aware of. So state police, the Marine Patrol, and then the fish and game, you know, they're also responsible for it on some lakes. I'll be blunt with the caller. There's not enough of those resources today to handle all of the, you know, all of the, to patrol all the lakes. We don't see them on Peach and Pond a lot. We don't see enforcement on Peach and Pond a lot. So she's right. You know, there's a lack of enforcement today. So, yeah, it's a challenge, and I wish the legislature would provide more resources.
Jack, on the other side, Michelle is saying, you know, are people knowing the rules? Are they being learning the rules? So before someone operates a boat of any sort on a Vermont lake, what must they do? What training, what licensing are they required to get?
Well, there are laws in Vermont for that, and I believe it's something like 14 years of age. They need to pass a test. It's not like a Department of Motor Vehicles where you get a license, but they do this online, and they need to have this knowledge. The one other point I'd like to make about the caller's question is thinking about the personal watercraft that you brought up earlier. That was instituted a few years ago. And on my lake and many lakes, this is a situation where when they're on your lake, they make a lot of noise. They're very obvious. And everyone on our lake calls the local police or the game warden, and they're there. And within half hour at least, and these boats are off the lake. So it's something that the citizens can see easily. And I would suggest that if you've seen a wake boat in operation, it's something you can see easily. So I think that some of this is going to fall, like with the personal watercraft, with citizens of Vermont calling and letting people know that this is happening.
All right, let's go to the back to the phones again. Jerry's joining us from Montpelier. Good morning, Jerry. Go right ahead.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you, gentlemen, for your work. Camp at Lake Carmine in Franklin, Vermont. I've been there for 40 years. No one, I don't think, up there understands the 200-foot rule. It's very difficult. And the young lady before me stole my question about enforcement. There is no enforcement. And it's because there's not enough game wardens and enough state police. So anyhow, that creates, and that 200 feet you were talking about, that, in my opinion, should be at least 500 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And especially people that can play out in the middle of the lake. Lake Carmine is a big lake. It's, 3 miles long, 2 miles across. It's 7 miles around. So it's very big. There's plenty of room to go to a different area.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm fishing out in front of my camp where most of the fish are, you know, within 200 feet, 500 feet of the shore, why are you doing donuts around me on your jet ski or whatever?
Right.
You got the rest of the lake to do that. The other point I wanted to make was, Lake Carmine has had a major problem with erosion around the lake caused by many boats. And now we don't have these wake boats up there yet. My son used to, you know, I'd bring him out on the speedboat and he'd go wakeboarding and he'd beg me to go slower, you know, make a bigger wave. Well, it was very hard to do in that type of boat. But it destroys the shoreline.
Yeah.
So everyone at Lake Carmine, not everyone, but a lot of people at Lake Carmine, buy dump truck loads of huge boulders and they pour them on their shoreline, so it helps slow down the erosion.
All right, Jerry, I'm going to try to get this back to the guest because we are almost out of time. But you know, Jerry mentions the 200-foot weight no wake zone should be 500. Mark and Jack, you would like it to be 1,000 feet. But I think one of the points that Jerry makes is these lakes, for the most part, are wide enough and long enough to allow for still plenty of this activity if there was a 1,000-foot no wake zone. So just, you know, Mark, give us an idea of whatever lake you're on, you know, how much that would allow for people to still be able to utilize the lake and have, you know, a wake boat out there.
Well, we haven't mapped Peach and Pond. We have worked with the state to map, I think Jack would know better, 6 or 7 or 8 different lakes in terms of where you could use it. It will eliminate the use of wake boats on some lakes, which is too small. You got to operate it 1,000 feet from shore or deeper than 20 feet of water. So there is a bunch of lakes that these boats will not be allowed to operate it if our petition is adopted as is. There's other ones where there's zones out in the middle of the lake. We've identified them, and we'd like the state to identify, you know, map more of the lake so it's very clear what, you know, where you can operate these boats safely.
Jack, you did put together a petition that you are presenting. First of all, you know, where's that going? Who does that go to? What are the steps that has to go through for this to become state law on the lakes of Vermont?
Excellent question, Rick. So we're going through a petition process, and the petition is submitted to the Agency of Natural Resources here in Vermont. They have in the past been given the authority by the legislature to make rule changes in the water uses, which is what we are asking them to do. So we're going through the petition process. We've submitted our petition in early March, and what the agency is doing right now is they're reviewing it legally and technically for the science, and we have a lot of science in our application. And now, just in the last few days, Rick, they're accepting written comments from the public, and then in the month of June, they'll be having 2 hybrid public meetings, and by that I mean you can attend in person or you can attend online for taking public comments. At that point, they will assemble the information they have and decide, you know, how they, that is the agency, how they want to proceed. Rick, there's one point that you made I just want to clarify that's quite important, and that is the 200-foot current shoreline no-wake protection area is in force. We're not asking that this be changed at all. This will still be in effect. What we're asking for is only for wake boats at 1,000 feet. I'm very sympathetic with your last caller. Yep. These wake boats are allowed to continue. They're going to have more erosion, but if they're further out in the lake, it's going to be much less to at least not worse than it is with ski boats. Hope that answers your question.
All right, well done. Let's take Paul very quickly. Paul, you want to make a point? Paul from Wilmington, go right ahead. Keep it short.
Yes. Good morning. As far as the 1,000-foot distance, I mean, that's approaching a quarter mile, which really means some smaller lakes would be kind of restricted in their entirety. Have other states implemented the 1,000-foot rule or the under 200-acre rule or whatever other measurements may be needed? What are other states doing kind of getting close to what Vermont is considering or what is being considered being proposed in Vermont?
Thanks, Paul. Mark, can you answer that pretty quickly?
I think it's all over the place in terms of, you know, each state has their own regulatory process that they have to go through. Ours is unique to Vermont. Again, what we've done is we've followed the science, and what we've seen is that that 1,000 feet is reasonable. If you look at the wake at so we have the 200-foot limit today, and the boats, water ski boats and tubing and whatever. If you take a wake boat out to 1,000 feet, that wave height and power is the same as a water ski boat at 200 feet.
Gotcha. So, Mark, we're going to have to leave it there. I apologize. This is what happens when we get this many calls. It was a good discussion. Mark Milazzo, Jack Widnes, members of Responsible Wakes for Vermont Lakes, and you can contact them by emailing responsiblewakesvt@gmail.com. Jack and Mark, thanks for being on with us this morning.
Thank you, Rick.
Thanks for having us.
All right, take care. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. April is National Poetry Month, and I have to admit I did very little on the subject last month except read some of the winning entries from the Weybridge Haiku Contest. So in order to make it up to St. David, the patron saint of poets, to poetry lovers everywhere, and to the angry mob of mad poets who have amassed outside our studios on Stowe Street, I'm having poetry guests on the show 2 days running. Joining me now from the Poetry Society of Vermont is the editor of its literary journal, The Mountain Troubadour, Mary Rose Daugherty. Mary Rose, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. It's really nice to be here.
Great having you. We also have the Mountain Troubadour's contributing editor, George Longenecker. George, thanks for being on the show as well.
Yes, good morning. Well, hopefully we can quell those pro-poetry protests outside the studio this morning.
Thanks, George. That would be really helpful. Listeners, to ask our guests about the Poetry Society of Vermont, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Mary Rose, what exactly is the Poetry Society of Vermont?
The Poetry Society of Vermont is an organization that's been around since 1947, and it's a member organization. Members get together to work on their poetry, and it's a very community. It's a community of writers that gets together and writes. We have three main events every year. We have a spring workshop, and our spring workshop is coming up on the 14th. So just to give you an example of what happens at that workshop is the writers submit their poems. We have a poet who has more expertise who receives them ahead of time and puts comments on them and so forth. And then we get together for the day. We have a lunch, and the afternoon is spent reviewing the comments that he or she or they put on the poems. And it's a learning experience for people to get feedback.
Yeah.
So that's just an example.
George, you're past president of the society. Any idea when it started back in 1947, why it got started or how?
Yes. Arthur Wallace Peach was chair of the English department at Norwich. And he wrote poetry. He's in an anthology of Vermont literature. And he and others who wrote wanted to have a like community. They saw it as a literary group, a social group. They were a little different than we are today. We'll get together and informally. They actually wore gowns and tuxes.
Ooh.
Some of their early gatherings had formal dinners.
Some of the protesters out front have the gowns and tuxes on, George, so just to let you know. They might be old members.
Yes.
Yeah. How many members does the group have today, George?
We have just over 100. We wanted it to. It's a small organization.
That's a lot of poets for the state of Vermont. All over the state, or where are they from?
They're from Shaftesbury to East Burke, Bennington County to Caledonia. We have people all over the state.
That's a wide swath.
Which now, is a problem if you only get together in person.
I would say.
It's horrendous not to minimize the pandemic and 15 million deaths worldwide. But in a way, it helped us because we learned Zoom.
Exactly. So, Mary Rose, how do you conduct activities now with the society? When do you get together and, you know, what types of things?
We, as I mentioned, we have the three main events that we do in the spring and in the fall. Those are both opportunities to have your work reviewed. And then there's a summer event, and this summer we're going to be pairing with the Stone Valley Arts downstate and joining them with their activities in August. So, and actually, I'm not real familiar. Maybe George can talk about it. Because of the pandemic, I haven't been to a summer event. It hasn't happened for a while. But there's also, as George said, there's a lot of informal things going on. So the society as a whole, and society, I think, in these days is a little off-putting word, but it does kind of harken back to those times where there were different ways of people forming. And, you know, like I know my grandparents in the, you know, early 1900s, there was a lot of social clubs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they were, today we might call them affinity groups. Mm-hmm. So we're an affinity group for poets, and it's a really a good way to get to know other people who are writing, and that's all it is, you know. So the word society shouldn't scare anybody away.
Yeah. George, I know, I think you were a professor teaching writing, history, geography maybe?
Yes, that's right.
So what types, what is it that interests you in poetry?
Well, I'm interested in the music, the musicality of language. And I'm also interested in issues after teaching all of those American and world history courses at Norwich and Vermont Tech. I did radio commentaries on The Point. I did about 200 of those over 20-something years. So I was always writing and interested in issues, but I wanted to turn it into verse.
Mm-hmm.
And poems are quick to write. And that doesn't mean you don't have to revise them a lot.
Right.
Easier to write than novels.
Well, do you have one at the ready that you do care to share with us?
I just was hoping you'd ask that.
Well done, George.
I wrote one that actually has Waterbury in it called Hurricane Irene, which I wrote after the 2011 hurricanes. I'll read you part of this.
All right.
Tiny streams gorged themselves on the deluge, became monsters who lifted huge boulders from beds where they'd lain since the last glacier. The flood heaved stones, uprooted trees, and hurled the mass downstream into houses. Water gushed through windows. Shingles, boards, and beams buckled, cracked, and splintered, then rolled down into rivers, risen far over their banks. No longer minor tributaries. All over Vermont, from Waterbury to Bethel, from Rochester to Marlborough, the water rolled. Streetlights flickered, then went out. A crushed car floated by, its interior lights still on. Coffins fled an eroded cemetery, followed by a swimming corpse, its stiff arms flailing. Two huskies howled and howled as their dog pen filled, but nobody could hear them over roaring water and pounding stones. Next day dawned warm, clear, and strangely silent, with an odor of decay as water settled. Soon blue jays called, crows hovered, diesel engines roared, but it would take months to fill and fix what Irene had done. Slowly the flood receded and stones settled. Flood water seeped out of houses and left oily muck on every plate and chair. Those who could returned home, saw what the water had done, and wept.
Mm. George, in verse, you took us back 11 years. It's almost like seeing photographs of what that devastation of Tropical Storm Irene did here in Vermont and in Waterbury. So Wow. Well done. How about you, Mary Rose? How long have you been writing poetry?
I first got interested in poetry when I was a sophomore in high school, which was not exactly yesterday. But and then that's actually the reason I came to Vermont, was to get my MFA in writing, and that was about 35 years ago. Mm. So I've been writing for quite a while. I think I would challenge George a little bit about poems being easy to write.
Standoff going on here this morning.
I tend to be more like Valerie, who said that you could write one poem and revise it the rest of your life. So would you like me to read one?
I would, please.
And part of what got me interested is that I have an evolution of my undergraduate degrees are in English and journalism, and so I spent some time in journalism. And then I came and got my MFA. But I kind of veered from, because in journalism I wanted to tell stories about what was going on in the world, and then I realized I really wanted to tell more personal stories. Mm-hmm. So this is a story from a time when I was working as a professional caregiver, and it's called Fine, and I'll just read it. I will keep you in my thoughts, I said, looking softly into your eyes. All those Mondays I'd girded my spirit against your willfulness just to show up to do laundry, dust, wipe out the bathroom sink, and scrub the toilet, if you'd let me. You were the crabby woman on the third floor none of us could stand, who'd call, "Yoo-hoo," not my name, when you wanted to tell me something. I arrived to find you in bed that last Monday, refusing food and drink. You were on your way out of your prison of physical pain, but still had instructions for me. Do the laundry, press the linen blouses. A woman so intentional, she focuses her attention on the mundane tasks, details of laundry, as a task she reserves towards dying. Then come back up here and sit after you put the laundry in. And I did, silently praying the new prayer I'd learned from Pema Chodron. May Annie know true happiness. May Annie know the root of true happiness. Practicing prayerful gratitude, embracing each person who came to mind, always spiraling back to you. Later, the laundry, the ironing complete, you hand motioned, bring them here. I brought the pressed blouses, smelling of steam heat, for your inspection, and you gently fingered each, saying, yes, this is fine. And then, standing aside your bed, I enclosed your hand in mine and held it.
Wow. Oh, my. This new edition of The Mountain Troubadour is dedicated to Anne B. Day, and she has several poems in The Troubadour. I want to read one. It is Ode to Dandelions. We had a farmer on, Alan LePage of Barry, earlier this week talking about dandelions, and I thought this would just be a perfect adjunct. Brave, brave dandelions, just as we had about given up ever seeing green again, you came to brighten our early spring with your spots of yellow in the not-yet-tilled gardens, the still brown roadsides, in ditches and edges along paths, in lawns and by the back porch. Yellow here, yellow there, you fill the fields with your fare before the time of planting of corn. Your deep roots frustrate gardeners, farmers, and lawn keepers, yet during those early weeks of grayness, we were blessed by hope and beauty when we needed it the most. And now, in your declining days, your silver seeds float on wisps of an early morning breeze. So, second, ode to the dandelion this week, a way to look at dandelions in a different manner. George, tell us, what is The Mountain Troubadour, and how long has it been published?
The Mountain Troubadour was started as a newsletter in 1947, and it's been a poetry journal, book-sized magazine, since 1956. It used to publish twice a year. In more recent years, we publish one good sized issue. Let's see, how many pages is this year?
I think it's over 100.
107.
It's, yeah.
107 pages.
Yeah. Mary Rose, do you know how the name was selected?
Yeah, the name was selected from, there was a reverend, a minister, I guess he was a priest in Northfield, and he was very interested in, he called himself the troubadour, and so some, I don't know exactly the lineage or the linkage, but somehow we believe that that filtered down and it got attached to the name of the magazine. But we do also know that from our archives that at one time it was going to be called Mountain Corn. And I'm really glad that it's not called Mountain Corn, because the troubadour actually has a historic bent to it, with being you know, poets that traveled and they did folklore and it, in a certain region of France and Italy. So there's a richer history behind troubadour than for poets, I think.
I think so too, George. As I mentioned, it is dedicated to Anne Day. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Yes, Anne Day has been a member since, I believe, 1959. She lived in Faiston until she sold her Knoll Farm, made sure that went into a land trust. She and her late husband were ski instructors. She was also a writer. She was a volunteer. She did volunteer work in Central America. She's a prolific poet. She's written more poems published in the Mountain Troubadour than anyone else. At 92, she's still writing and publishing, as you saw with that poem that you just read, and a prolific photographer as well.
So just to be clear about that, George, she joined in 1959, and the organization started in 47.
Yep.
So she's been a member for almost all of our years, except for 12.
Yeah, how about that? And I'm just noticing the new edition is out, and there indeed is a dandelion on the cover. So
talk about resonances when you were talking about having Alan LePage here.
Mm-hmm.
This is sent in by a member's husband, this photograph. And I had no idea if I would use it. And at first I thought it was really lovely because there is some blue, really iridescent color to
right.
it, and it's a fading dandelion. And then lo and behold, there was Anne's poem, and we had to celebrate the 75 years. And, you know, the more I got into our archives and found out about who she was, it really had to have a dedication to her.
What a perfect symmetry, how it all came together. George, how are the poems selected for inclusion in the Mountain Troubadour?
Well, we have an editorial board, and they read the poems, make comments, and rank them on a numerical scale. So it's actually pretty systematic. Mary Rose has done more of this than I have now.
Yeah.
So after the editorial board looks at them, they send them on to me, and they're scored. And I have the ultimate decision of, you know, what goes in and what doesn't go in. Generally, I think most of the ones that they earmark go in. This year there were two really great poems that I left out because they just didn't seem to cohere with the story that was being laid out in the book. So, but you know, if it's a good poem, it's a good poem, and we really want to publish good poems.
Yeah. How do non-members get a copy of The Mountain Troubadour?
They can go to our website and order one.
And that is Mountain Troubadour VT,
Poetry Society of Vermont.org.
All right, good. I'm going to read another poem, if you don't mind, from The Mountain Troubadour. This is by Lily Henriksen, and it's a short one, and it goes like this. I found a poem in my shoe. I don't know that's what it was. I didn't know that's what it was. I was preoccupied with the stab between my toes. and miss seeing the damselflies mating above the primrose, and the call of the tufted titmouse on the birch's arm, and the blue cohosh hiding at the trail's edge. I limped along the path, cursing the discomfort, until I could take it no longer, slipped off my shoe, and out dropped words for beauty.
So what I really love about that poem, and the reason I made it the opener, it's a poem about poetry, but it's also a poem about how we miss so much in our lives by, bending towards the distractions and the pain. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't let us forget that as she goes through the whole thing. So I just thought it was a really good place to start our discussion this year.
I agree. And Brian Pfeiffer, the naturalist, who loves dragonflies and damselflies, will probably love that poem as well. Mary Rose Daugherty, George Longenecker, members of the Poetry Society of Vermont, and editors of its literary journal, The Mountain Troubadour. You can learn more about the society, and you can visit poetrysocietyofvermont.org. Mary Rose and George, thanks so much for being on the show this morning.
Thank you, Rick. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks to DEV for having us.
Absolutely. And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Feel free to suggest guests or topics for the show by emailing vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we discuss cardboard creations, celebrity storytelling, and the letter carrier food drive.